Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 22nd, 2009, and this is show number 192. We're getting there, guys. Well, hey, remember last week when I did a call to arms? I said I needed to enlist the power of the podfeet, that my honor was at stake. Remember how Bart had the audacity to suggest that my buddy Ron's photo of me with the French maids was only so popular because there were French maids in the photo? Well, in the call to arms, I asked you to take a look at the photo and to tell your friends, and man, did you guys come through. Before I asked you to take a look at the photo, it had around 4,800 views. And just the chat room alone from the live show at ustream.tv/nosilicast, just the chat room alone pushed it up by over 100. That was amazing. But get this, within 24 hours, the photo had been viewed 6,200 times. That's 1,400 views in just one day. As of right now, the photo has been viewed over 7,000 times. I was trying to get you guys to take it over 6,000. It's over 7,000. Let's see, Evan tells me that at this exact instant that I'm recording, it's at 7,209 views. Can you believe this? Well, Ron sent me a great graph that he entitled The Power of the Podfeet that shows this flat graph with about 20 views a day, and on Monday it shows this huge spike with, like, what is it, 1,297 views on that day alone. Heck, there's a whole pile of comments, too. It's really worth reading the comments. They really made me smile. Thank you to everyone who posted there. Well, I think this settles it, and I thank you for your support. I do have to make sure, though, that in the future, I only enlist the power of the Podfeet for good and not evil. Well, almost a month ago, Chuck wrote an excellent comment on the blog in response to my complaint about there not being any ISO burning tools built into Windows. Thanks, by the way, for all the people who pointed out that Microsoft has finally built it into Windows 7. Anyway, in show number 188 a month ago, I talked about a beautiful freeware tool called ImageBurn, and Chuck's comment talks a little bit about that. I wanted to read you a bit of it and then put a link back to his comment so you can learn how to rock the rock with the cool kids, as he says. Here's an excerpt of his comment. Allison, a comment on ISO burning. I'm platform neutral and have used ImageBurn for some time now and love it. Whenever I fix a PC, I install it. As mentioned by Debbie T, Disk Utility does burn from ISO images. But if you really want to rock with the cool kids on a Mac, you've got to open up Terminal and do it from the command line. The command hdiutil has more options than you can imagine, but burning with it couldn't be easier. In this example, I burned the disk image pinocchio.iso to a CD. For simplicity, I moved the image file to my home folder. The user types in the bit after the dollar sign. All the rest is progress reported by the system. I don't know what it is about stuff like this, but I just love that Chuck sent this in. It's an easy and free way to do something that's actually very simple for the OS to do, but it requires that geek courage to just open the command line and jump in. I put a link directly to Chuck's comment so you can read along and test it out. It's actually very short, and Chuck gives great descriptions. Thanks, Chuck, and sorry it took me so long to acknowledge your work here. Well, I've mentioned a couple of times on the show how Will wrote an awesome script for me that changes a whole bunch of the defaults in GarageBand 09 for me, so I don't have to spend 10 minutes every week clicking a bunch of buttons. For some inane reason, GarageBand 09, when you tell it you want to make a podcast, not a music thing, but a podcast, it opens the new file with the metronome on. Now, why would someone want the metronome on with their voice? That doesn't make any sense. Well, to go along with the metronome, instead of showing you how long you've been recording at time, the default is to show you how many beats you've been recording. Now, come on, does even a musician want to know how many beats? Like, are you paid by the record labels for how many beats you record, or you have a beat limit or something? Well, they also set the two preset male and female voices to have reverb on. Now, come on, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? It just sounds silly. Well, they also set the voices to be mono one-half, which means that they're mono, but only out of, like, your left ear. That one's been true since the last version, and it drives me nuts. So every episode, I was having to turn all these things off. And anyway, Will wrote me this great script. Well, because of my excitement about Will's latest script, folks have been emailing me asking if they can have a copy of it. So Will has started posting them on his website at iwillsite.110mb.com. There's a link in the show notes, of course. Head on over there and click on the I Will Script tab, and you'll be able to get your very own copy of his scripts. I think his site is very cleverly organized, by the way. It's all different things that I will do. Get it? Anyway, he's been doing some modifications, actually, in the last couple of days so that it's very tailored to however you want to have the episodes named. So my script, he made it so it always names it NC underscore year month day of the day I'm recording, because that's why I name my episodes. But he set it up where you can have a version number. You know, you could have it say 192, and the next week it'll say 193. And he also did modify both of the voices. I only needed the female voice modified. So anyway, he's doing some great work. Go check his site out over at iwillsite.110mb.com.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Michael writes in with a really interesting question, and I love this approach. Dear Allison, I'm a recent switcher to the Mac and have been listening to podcasts like yours to learn more about the Mac and the software available to me, since where I work it is strictly a PC shop and my friends still tend to be on PCs. When I set up my Mac, I created a user account without admin privileges, separate from my admin account, as I have heard this is best practice. I only log into my user account. So here's my dumb question. Although I went into System Preferences and set Software Update to run daily and update automatically, in my user account, it appears to do nothing. Under Last Check, it does not show that I checked for updates daily. If I log in with my admin account, I will get Apple updates, or the software update will show that it checked. In my user account, if I ask the OS to check for updates, I have no trouble requesting and then receiving updates, although, of course, I have to enter the admin credentials to enable the update. On the other hand, I have no trouble being notified automatically about Firefox updates. Have I inadvertently set a parameter somewhere that blocks me from receiving automatic updates? How would I see this? And further, short of emailing you, how do I find the answer using Apple resources? I couldn't get anywhere checking their website. Thanks in advance and keep up the good work. Regards, Michael. Michael, this is actually a great question. And I didn't know the answer, so I had to do some searching, which also helps me answer your second question of how to find answers. First, I tried making a new user account so I could find out what Apple calls a non-admin account. Turns out they call it standard. Armed with that exact name, I was able to Google OS X Standard Account Software Update. This gave me a bunch of hits immediately. The first hit was discussions.apple.com, which is where I was going to tell you to go for answers if you need help in the future anyway. It's a great site with a lot of user interaction. A lot of people put in good information in there. I was able to find a lively discussion on this exact topic. And the good news is you didn't do anything wrong. Apple has specifically designed it this way. The purpose of having standard users in a normal situation would be, say, for a business or a home where you have one geek who's the admin who's in charge of doing things like doing software updates. The idea is that the standard users are not supposed to be able to install anything without adult supervision anyway, so offering them an update that they can't install because they don't have the admin password would just be kind of, a tease. What they could have done to be more clear is not let you even check the button Check for Updates. It should have been grayed out or unavailable, in my opinion. In your case, and probably with a lot of people, you do know the admin password. You're just running as a standard user so that things don't run off, you know, installing themselves without your permission. With OS X, that's not really a problem yet, because whenever you try to install anything, OS X will ask you for the admin password, even if you are already logged into an administrator account. Now, that's not the case with Windows, and I'm going to digress a little bit here because I don't understand this. Even on Vista, all Vista does if you try to install software is say, well, are you sure you want to hit install? And then it goes ahead if you just click yes. I've never understood why Microsoft thought that was a good idea and doesn't make you enter your credentials. I've also heard people complain about the Mac always asking you for your credentials, but I'm really happy they do. Now, I know a lot of security people say you should always run as this limited standard user, but I have yet to be presented a logical argument about how it can protect you, since in both types of accounts, you can enter your admin password and keep going. The recent Trojan horse, for example, that people got stung by when stealing iWork09 online through illegal file sharing sites, that thing worked because people knew they were installing something, in this case iWork, and so they put in their admin passwords. Well, it's lucky Bart isn't on the show today, or he'd tell me the reason I'm all wet about this. Well, I guess he'll have to correct me when he gets back next week and tell me whether he thinks we really should run as standard users, but I'll make him convince me of exactly why that would be the case. Actually, I hope he does weigh in, because I do respect his security opinion. I hope that answered your question, and I'd like to keep this channel open for you on questions, dumb and otherwise. Like I said, the Apple discussion forums are great, and you'll also start meeting people through the NoSilicast who are very willing to help. A great idea is to come to the live show sometime at ustream.tv/NoSilicast. I record live at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sundays, if that works in your time zone. Just come on in, say hello, and the folks in there are very helpful. And remember, they also remember what it was like when they were first getting started. I can also highly recommend the Typical Mac User podcast for more beginner-level learning. But you gotta watch out because he sneaks in advanced stuff too, like the terminal stuff that Bart does with him. You can also check out the Switch Mac blog at switchmac.com. That was designed by a switcher for switchers. Rob Hansen has been chronicling his journey through the Mac for a year now, so the archives are a treasure trove of information. That actually ought to be able to help you. Well, George from Tulsa joins us again with a tip on how to improve the import process for iPhoto and aperture from your camera.
George from Tulsa, with a simple way to improve what happens when you import pictures into iPhoto and aperture. I don't like the iPhoto import process. Enough said. Here's the tip. First, tell your Mac not to open any application when a camera is attached. You'll find that option in iPhoto Preferences. Close iPhoto. Create a folder on your desktop. Name the folder with the event name you want. Attach your camera or camera card. Drag the pictures you want to import to your new folder. This is a great time to use Quick Look or Preview to BART and discard ones you don't want to keep. Optionally, name the survivors. Your unborn grandchildren thank you. Finally, just drag the folder onto the iPhoto icon in your dock. iPhoto will open, create an event with the same name as the folder, and import all the pictures in your folder into the new event. Aperture is a bit different. Open Aperture and drag the folder into the Aperture sidebar. This tip, simple as it is even easier to follow in the Screen Steps tutorial I sent Allison. Happy BARTing!
Well, George has turned into a recording and screen steps maniac these days, hasn't he? I put a link in the show notes to George's Screen Steps tutorial if you want to see exactly what he's talking about. I think this process has merit, but it might be a personal preference how you want to do it. One thing you can do in Aperture is BART the photos on the way in. You can see thumbnails that are pretty big, enough to tell you, to at least tell you which one the really dorky ones are and never import them in the first place. One huge advantage of George's method for iPhoto users, if you name the photos before they come in, then the originals in iPhoto have the real names. One of the things that bugs the daylights out of me for iPhoto is that if you export a perfectly named photo to disk, it reverts back to DSCN_2332 instead of the name that you gave it. Unless they've changed that in more recent versions, I haven't checked lately. In Aperture, when you export, you have a choice of either exporting a version or the master, and if you choose version, you get the name you've so carefully given your photo. Duh! Well, there are two disadvantages of George's strategy, in my opinion. One is that you have to go back and delete those photos that you imported onto your disk before pulling them into your photo management tool. The second issue is that you don't have a way of easily viewing and naming the photos in the folder in the first place. That's one of the reasons you need an iPhoto or Aperture to be able to see the photos in full size to decide what to name them. You can pop them open in Quick Look at the desktop level and then collapse them back and do the naming, but that's kind of tedious. Like I said, this is an interesting way to go about it, and I bet this tip will help some of you to find a better way to deal with importing your photos. Thanks again, George. Well, speaking of Screen Steps, have you bought it yet? This is my favorite tool these days. Okay. Feeder's right up there for creating my show notes and delivering the podcast. I don't know if that one's ever going to be knocked off its pedestal. But anyway, I use Screen Steps constantly to create documentation to answer people's questions. For example, my mother and father-in-law asked me if I would write up some instructions for them on how to troubleshoot their Linksys wireless router when their MacBook loses the signal. They didn't want to keep bugging me or wait forever for me to call them back, and they wanted to learn how to do things themselves. I jumped onto Screen Steps. I took screen snapshots with it of the configurations of the Linksys interface. I was able to draw little boxes around the links I wanted them to click, put arrows pointing at relevant things, and even put in sequence numbers. And then in the text field, I was able to put the corresponding numbers to walk them through each step. It took me no time at all to do this, and it was really quite fun. Even better, once I was done, I realized this might be of use to some other folks too. So I clicked Export to WordPress. Right inside Screen Steps, I chose that I wanted it to be a page, and it plopped nicely into my tutorial section in the right-hand sidebar on Podfeet. I clicked Export again, and this time I chose PDF so I could mail it to my in-laws so they could print it out and keep it handy the next time they needed it. The next time you have to answer the question, how do I... or the next time you embark on a complicated process yourself that you're afraid you'll forget how to do next time, download a free trial from screensteps.com, and then when it makes you happy, because it will, go back and buy it and use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, to get 25% off the purchase price. If you're too lazy to remember how to find all this, there's a big picture of Screen Steps in the right-hand sidebar on the website. Just click it and then type in the coupon code and you'll get your 25% off. Well, it's altogether possible that I am the last person on Earth to get Delicious Library. It's been around for like 100 years, I think. But in case just maybe two or three of you out there don't know about it, I wanted to do a little review. Well, let's start with the problem to be solved. You're a maniac at buying DVDs and you've amassed a huge collection. You find yourself wondering, wait, do I own 50 First Dates or was that Groundhog's Day I own? Or you go looking for The Matrix and it's not there and you can't remember who you loaned it to. Or maybe you've just sat down and done the math on exactly how much money you've invested in those darn DVDs and you figure you'd better record them for insurance in case of fire. I bet you think that last reason's silly, but trust me, 200 DVDs, even at $15 a piece, that's $3,000 on an insurance claim if your house goes up in flames. That list and a photo of the stack in your house, and you are golden. It actually means more than having the receipts from things I've learned through very unfortunate circumstances. Now my idea doesn't sound so silly, does it? Well, years ago I bought an app called DVD Cache from humantrain.com, and I loved it. I painstakingly typed in every single name, let it run a slow search that seemed to take forever, and then I peered through all the varieties of each DVD shown. Was it the special edition widescreen with the director's cut? Well, anyway, it took a long time to do each one, and lots of the times it didn't even come up with the album art, so I had to go to Amazon through DVD Cache and copy the covers and paste them in. Once I did that all that heavy lifting, though, on 178 DVDs, I had it all. I was really happy. I could see all my DVDs to check what I had. I could mark DVDs as loaned out and even access my Apple address book to show who I loaned it to and mark on a calendar when they borrowed it and when I got it back or when I hoped to get it back. I only used that part once and it worked great until the person returned the DVD to me. When they borrowed it, it was bright red in the list, but when I tried to mark it as returned, it never cleared that color at all. And that gets to the reason I walked away finally from DVD Cache. Sadly, I walked away. The developer simply lost interest. He wrote back once or twice when I had a problem, but he never solved the problems, and he never issued another update. I paid my $20 shareware fee, but I never really got any support or an update. I mean, he did write back, but he didn't do anything. So forever I'd heard people talk about a cool tool called Delicious Library. And when I heard that it came out in version 2, I thought, maybe I finally better do it. The main draw to Delicious Library is that instead of typing in all those names again, and Steve and I bought even more DVDs since I scanned into DVD, since I typed them into DVD Cache, I wanted to use Delicious Library because you can use your eyesight camera as a barcode scanner, so there's no typing at all. How cool is that? I wasn't sure what else it could do, but when I saw it on sale at Macworld Expo for only $30 instead of the usual $40, I called my friend Nancy and told her, "Why don't you buy me this for Christmas?" I know that sounds weird, but trust me, this is not a weird thing. We do that kind of thing all the time. She just calls me and says, "Hey, this is what I want for Christmas," and it can be in June. It doesn't matter when we do it. So anyway, after the expo, I loaded it up and got to work. Let's get one thing out of the way right off the bat. I was very disappointed with Delicious Library's ability to read the barcodes on my DVDs with the eyesight. That would be the main reason I bought it, right? Delicious Library can't read at least... One out of five, one out of four DVDs barcodes. Seriously, it's so annoying. I assumed I was just doing something wrong. Was I too close, too far away? Why were there two green boxes to show you where to hold it? And then I started getting superstitious. I know, last time I came slowly down from above when it did work. Maybe you have to sneak up on it. Well, anyway, when it did work, I was really happy, but the failure rate was way too high for my taste. I did go online and read forums, and nobody had a solution, and the Delicious Library people ain't talking. All right, now for the good news. The lookup in Delicious Library is blazingly fast compared to DVD cache. Really wasn't bad at all typing in the names of the DVDs. In a split second, would find all the options, but I do wish the image they showed you was a lot bigger. The text listing wouldn't say if it was widescreen or special edition, so you frequently had to look very closely at this teeny tiny little picture to see if it was the right one. Suppose that's not critical, but if you're this anal and you really want to do this kind of thing, you kind of want to know that you got the right one. Well, after all of my whining, I would say that it took me no more than about 2 hours to scan and type in 225 DVDs. It's only about 30 seconds per DVD, which is really pretty good. I did all this work before I even took a look at what I was going to be able to do with Delicious Library when I was done, but I was pleasantly surprised at what I found. Back with DVD cache, I could create HTML pages and then upload them to my website. The HTML was a little cruddy looking, nothing to be thrilled at, but for 5 years ago, that was pretty hot stuff. The big drag, though, was that when I added one stinking movie, I had to upload the entire thing over again. I looked around for a way to upload from Delicious Library to the web, and at first I couldn't find it. Oh no, having all this great info but not being able to put it online is just nonsense. Well, Nancy and I went to the Delicious Library website over at delicious-monster.com. Right there on the front page, it says you can upload to the web. So I went back home and I started hunting around, and eventually I found it. It's under Publish to FTP Site. I guess I should have figured that out, but how about Push to Web or something? You know, the word web in there? Well, anyway. Well, it took me quite a while to figure out how to tell it the configuration of my website. Further digging explained that I could just use my transmit preferences, which is the FTP software I just happened to use. Yay! But how do I get it from transmit to Delicious Library? Eventually I figured out that you have to export to text from transmit. I wasn't even exactly sure how the heck I got Delicious Library to read the file in the endgame, but in fact it has now every web server I've ever connected to, most of which I'd prefer to delete from the list. But Delicious Library insists on keeping them all in a nice long list, so I have to scroll to get to Podfeet every time. It's kind of a minor niggle, but they made the discovery on this whole web part way more exciting and adventurous than it needed to be. But it does work. After you tell it to FTP to your site, it has a little indicator that starts to say it's doing it, and then it goes away very quickly. But when it's done, it's not really done, because it's got to put all that text up there, it's got to put up all the images. So I thought it wasn't working. But much later, I got a message from Delicious Library up on screen telling me that it was finished. I would have liked some indicator that it was still working. In fact, when I updated the library after putting in another 100 or so DVDs, I forgot that it doesn't tell you when it's done. So I went to all the trouble of throwing all of the work it had done away on my server and reran the whole thing because I thought it hadn't worked. That took me quite a while. Even if it just had an indicator that said, hey, this is going to take me a while. Go outside and play. I'll put up a note when I'm done. That would have been a lot better. Now it's time to point out how pretty Delicious Library is. The web viewing is just gorgeous. You click on a DVD label and it comes up on screen, leaving everything else still there in the background. You can expand each DVD to the full description, again, without opening a new web page. As beautiful as the Delicious Library web interface is, though, it's lacking some very basic functionality that really makes it more fluff than useful. For example, the DVDs are not in alphabetical order. They're not in genre order either, which appears to be the only way you can view them in the library interface, which also drives me nuts. On the web, I think about the first two-thirds seem to be in an alphabetical order, and the ones I added later seem to follow those and be in completely random order. What on earth use is that? I keep thinking there's got to be a preference I'm missing or something here. I would be really delighted if someone sends me an email after hearing me complain about this and says, oh, Allison, you're being a moron again. All you have to do is dot, dot, dot. I would be really happy if you tell me that. I'd be really happy if you tell me that there's search, too, since I'd likely use this for a do we already own 50 first dates or was that Groundhog's Day type question. If I have to flip through, I mean, all these pages, I mean, it's pages, I think I've got 14 pages of these and it's got to repaint everything, that would drive me nuts. I mean, completely unusable for that. Another thing that would be useful in the library and the web is how long is this movie? I simply couldn't find it in either interface. We had to resort to IMDb, which sort of ruined the fun. I expected to kind of have all the information about the movie. I was surprised to discover that Delicious Library had also indexed my iTunes, and it posted on the web a link to all my movies, music, and TV shows. Of course, for me, the music section is kind of dopey since it's like 95% podcasts, but if you actually had music in your music library, this is really kind of cool. Delicious Library can do so much more than I even bought it for. You can record your books, gadgets, software, video games. Heck, it's even got a thing for your tools and apparel. Overall, I think the tool is pretty cool, and it's nice for me to be working with a tool that's modern, but I'd like to see some real improvements to search both in the tool and especially the web interface. Actually, I shouldn't say that. There is search in the tool, and that works perfectly, but I'd like to be able to search in the web interface, and I'd like to be able to alphabetize. I can't quite give Delicious Library the full 5 pod feet seal of approval yet, but go check it out at delicious-monster.com. And if you know how to fix the issues I have with it, I am all ears. I just got to be wrong on this one because it's got to be able to do that, right? Well, Donald Burr is back with another one of his fabulous reviews.
Hi, this is Donald Burr of the Takano Podcast and Voices of Aaron Podcast, here with another review for you. I'd like to apologize off the top because I'm suffering from a bit of a cold, so you might have noticed by my voice. So I apologize for that. Also, I'm hopped up on a combination of caffeine and cold medicine, a very dangerous combo which I feel should be outlawed by the DEA. Anyways, on to the review. One of the biggest announcements to come out of this year's Macworld is the new iLife 09 suite. iPhoto 09 in particular comes with a bunch of awesome new features. Faces, of course, which is the face detection algorithm, which I found works very, very well. And Places, the first practical application of a technology that's been around for a while now, geotagging. Geotagging is the technique where you embed GPS coordinate data into the pictures that you take. That way, you store the location of where you took the picture in the picture. This makes organizing your pictures very easy, especially with iPhoto 09's Places feature. With Places, you can easily drill down by city, country, location, and even landmark to find the pictures that you took at that exact spot. It's really, really cool. The problem is that until recently, cameras have not had geotagging support built into them. Right now, for example, I'm only aware of 2 cameras that have GPS built in. That is the Nikon Coolpix P6000 and some weird camera by GE of all people. Also, if you have a high-end Nikon or Fuji DSLR, you can add a GPS attachment that sits on top of your camera's flash shoe. But what do we do if we don't want to upgrade our camera right now? Simple. You can buy something called a GPS logger. Basically, this is a small device that you can easily carry with you. It constantly communicates with the GPS satellites and logs your current position onto its built-in memory. Later, when you get back to your computer and import your pictures, it matches up these GPS logs with the pictures' timestamps, and that way it can figure out where you took each picture. One such unit is the AMOD AGL3080 GPS logger, and that's the unit that I'll review today. The AMOD is a very small and lightweight unit. It's about the size and weight of an old-school pocket pager, so it's really easy to carry in your camera bag. It comes with a little carabiner-like strap that you can use to lash it onto your camera bag or your camera. But I found that if you use this, it tends to kind of swing around wildly while you're walking and kind of gets in the way. So I just stuffed it in the pocket of my camera bag. It's powered by 3 AAA batteries and has an advertised battery life of 15 hours. And I found this is generally pretty accurate. This long battery life means that you can turn it on in the morning, go out for a full day of photo shooting, and it'll last the entire day. This is great. The unit's also very simple to operate. It only has 2 buttons, and really, you only need to use one of them, the power button. Just hold it down for a few seconds to turn it on or turn it off. This is nice because that way, if it's jostling around in your camera bag, it can't accidentally turn itself on or off. Once it's turned on, it's literally a set-it-and-forget-it device. Just turn it on, stuff it in your camera bag, go out and take pictures, and when you're done, turn it off. It has three status lights on it that tell you what's going on. The main one is the green GPS light. This light glows steadily while it's searching for a GPS signal and blinks when it has acquired one. Another light indicates its battery status. Normally this light is off. When it turns on, that means the batteries are running low and should be replaced soon. And finally, the third light indicates when the unit is accessing its built-in memory. When you first switch the unit on, it'll take about 2 to 3 minutes to acquire the initial GPS signal. Once it has acquired a GPS signal, however, this unit, I found, is extremely accurate. In fact, it can even receive GPS signals while indoors sometimes, which technically shouldn't be possible. This is no doubt because this unit uses the Surfstar 3 GPS chipset, which is reported to be highly sensitive. It has 128 megs of built-in memory to store GPS log data. This may not seem like much, but on a 6-hour outing that I recently went on, it only generated a 6 megabyte file, so this is plenty of memory for even the longest of photo trips. Once you get back to your computer, you simply offload the GPS data files by plugging the AMOD GPS into your computer. It uses a standard mini-B type USB plug. The GPS logger's memory mounts on your computer's desktop, just like a USB flash drive. When you open that drive, you'll find one or more text files. These are the actual GPS logs, which you can easily copy off of the GPS logger onto your hard drive using Finder or whatever. The next task is combining these GPS log files with your picture files. GPS data contains time information, so the idea is, as you read through the GPS data, you compare the times that the GPS logs with the timestamps of your actual image files. That way, you can associate a given set of GPS coordinates with one or more image files. The AMOD unit comes with software for both PC and Mac that does this for you. It's called JetPhoto, and it's okay. I mean, it's got the basic features for importing, organizing, and sharing your photos, and for browsing them via location. But these are just basic features. And in the case of the Mac, iPhoto does all of these things much better. That's the whole point. I want to use iPhoto and its Places feature. Here's the problem. iPhoto can read GPS information if it's stored in the picture file itself. So if you have a camera with built-in geotagging, you're fine and dandy. But iPhoto doesn't know anything about external GPS units like the AMOD. We need a third program that'll take your image files, plus the GPS data from the AMOD, correlate the two, and embed the GPS data for each image in the actual image file. That way, when iPhoto imports your images, it'll pick up this information and properly utilize it. For that, I use the $30 How to Geo program available from How to Software. So, when I plug in my camera's memory card, instead of directly importing into iPhoto, I first have to use How to Geo to process my image files based on the GPS data from the AMOD unit. Once that process is complete, then I can import into iPhoto. It sounds difficult, but really it's not that bad, and I've created an excellent screencast that shows how I do it. You should also check out Don McAllister's screencast about How to Geo. He made some excellent screencasts that show off this program's other excellent features, including a really cool way you can make flying tours of your photos using Google Earth. How to Geo has kindly made his screencasts available for free at the How to Geo website. All in all, I'm very satisfied with the AMOD unit. It's small, easy to carry, does its job, and does it well. And it's cheap. At $69, it's priced even within reach of an enthusiast or a novice, yet it has enough power for a professional. I give it 4.5 out of 5 stars. For my full review of the AMOD GPS unit, including my screencast on how I use the How to Geo software with it, and links to Don McAllister's screencast on How to Geo, check out the link that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to go cough up a hairball or two. Hope you enjoy the review, and see you next time.
Hello, Allison and all her podcast listeners worldwide. This is Honda Bob, in person. Allison asked me to say a few words about my business. Well, I guess that since I've been in business in the Southern California area for 30 years now, I have a good reason to be proud to allow Allison to advertise for me. This is ad number 100 of the commercials on Allison's podcast. Wow. I am registered with the California Bureau of Consumer Affairs Automotive Division. What that means is that I am certified by the state of California to perform all maintenance on your Honda or Acura automobile. This includes service required by the factory warranty to maintain your vehicle in tip-top condition. While the vehicle is under warranty, any repairs will be referred to an authorized Honda Acura dealer. My business ethic is simple. Do the best job for the best price at your location and your convenience. So, if you want your car to perform in tip-top condition, call me anytime at 562-531-2321 or log on to my website at hdabob.com. There, you will find all sorts of valuable information on how your vehicle works, from the headlights to the satellite navigation to the exhaust system. I explain in plain language how they work. HDA Bob's Mobile Service has no affiliation with Honda Worldwide or any Honda or Acura dealership. Thank you.
Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond, but this time I'm actually talking to a different Belgian. Tonight we're going to have Nightwise from Nightwise.com, Nightwise TV, all kinds of Nightwise sort of things. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. It's great to be on the NoSillaCast, Allison. Great to be here.
Well, for those of you that don't remember where I actually met Nightwise, well, I'm not exactly sure where we met, but he's been helping me with certain Linux things like my exciting adventure putting Ubuntu on my OLPC. He was part of that Los Angeles to Ireland to Belgium down to the Philippines to get that done. And he's also famous for the Klingon Honda Bob ad.
Well, yeah, kind of those things. I was indeed able to get in touch with a Klingon commander and was able to pry a little commercial out of him because he was so absolutely fond of Honda Bob.
That was a lot of fun. Well, we've also got your wife here, Niana, right?
Hi there.
So one of the things I wanted to start with here, we're going to get into some Linux talk here because I want to get some ideas from you of where you think Linux is going in terms of how mainstream it is. But I got to back up a little bit. I feel funny calling you Nightwise because I'm pretty sure that's not your name. What is your actual name?
Well, my actual name is Jo Hendrix, which has syllables in it that Americans find very hard to pronounce. And since I don't have a cool name like Bart, which is actually called Bart Buschholz, and who can really turn it into Bart Buschholz, which to me sounds like a nightclub, I'm unable to do so. So I went with my internet nick that I found, that I chose about 12 years ago, 13 years ago or something, and hence the name Nightwise. And because I've used it so much, it kind of stuck. I respond to it. People know me as Nightwise because if I say Jo Hendrix, there's absolutely nobody who scratches. Everybody's scratching their head going like, who?
Who's that guy? Okay, so it won't sound funny if I say, so Nightwise.
Yeah, yeah. It's really natural for us to be using our internet handles. Because we around the net, I'm usually around English-speaking people. And it comes from the days that we were on IRC. That's like, what, the
12 years ago 12 to 13 years ago
13 years ago we were on a chat box together and we used to go out with these people, and it would be common knowledge to call each other by their IRC or internet handle. So
even when you met in MeetSpace, huh?
Yeah, is that where you meet people, like outside?
Yeah, I've heard about it. I don't do it very often, but I've heard other people do it. Now Niana is your real name though?
No, it's not.
So
it's I've got an even harder one to pronounce.
All right, give us a shot.
Yeah, it's Saskia Goffin.
Okay, maybe you can spell that for me for the show notes, but Saskia Goffin.
Almost.
I missed some syllables. I think.
Yeah, it's more with a French.
Yeah, you know,
French tongue to it.
So, Goffin. Yeah. Goffin.
Hofer.
Yeah. Yeah.
But people over here get it wrong also, so.
So Niana works then.
Yeah, it works fine.
I think but you guys, people, you actually call each other sometimes at home by your chat names.
Yeah.
That happens. Unfortunately, that indeed happens. That's
yeah. If he hears his normal name, Jo, then he knows that something's wrong.
You're in trouble, huh?
Yeah.
When I get the full official Meneer Hendricks, then I know I'm in deep, deep trouble.
Or something's wrong with the computer.
Yeah.
One way or the other. Well, let's actually dig into some technology stuff here. I wanted to bring you on because you do a lot of interesting stuff on your show about using Linux. And I wanted to ask you what you think the state of the union is on Linux as far as how mainstream is it today? Do you really think it will get to a mainstream place? And you know, just your general opinion on that.
I think that there are a few things that we should take a look at. One of them being what do you expect from your operating system? If we take the question, is Linux ready for the mainstream, and we take a look at the average user who does some email, internet, Skype, watching a DVD, stuff like that, yes, then it's ready for the mainstream. It can do anything another operating system can do. On the other hand, it depends on what you want to do. If you say, like, I do this in Windows or I do this on a Mac, and the Linux system isn't there yet or the development isn't there yet, then it's maybe not ready for the mainstream. But for 99% of everything that people do, I would say it is. It still scares a lot of people getting into it, but I think a lot has changed over the last... Let's see, I've been toying with Linux for about 10 years. A lot has changed in about 10 years. I am somebody who would put Linux without a shadow of a doubt on any end user system and see how it goes and be pretty confident that it works.
Now, it's possible I'm not mainstream, but the thing I've found is while in a generic setup like just an Ubuntu or a CentOS install, I can do 95% of what I would want to do. I can get on the internet and I can do, you know, look at mail and all that kind of thing and the office applications through OpenOffice or whatever. And that's all fine. The place I just hit a brick wall is the minute I want to install something. And then it's like RPM package get I get scared. So
make install.
Bad.
Yeah. It's true. A lot of And I'm talking a little bit about the history of the Linux community over the last few years. A lot has changed since Ubuntu has come along. Ubuntu, the community, has a different philosophy of helping out newer users. It used to be like that if you went to a news group, like a real NNTP server, like the old days, and you would ask a question that would be kind of novice, they would flame you to the other side of the planet. And that has changed. It has been made more accessible for end users. I, for one, know that on an Ubuntu system, an installation using the command line is quite simple, and an installation using a package that you downloaded is quite simple. It isn't there yet on the RPM side, on the Red Hat and the Debian, and the Red Hat and the SUSE side, because they still use that RPM stuff, which can get you into trouble.
Don't use RPMs on, and I don't even know what RPM stands for those people listening, so I just know there's an RPM thing for installing. You don't use that on Ubuntu?
No. You see, on a Windows PC, you have an exe file.
Right.
And on Red Hat-based systems, like Red Hat, Fedora, SUSE, Mandriva, if I'm not mistaken, they have RPM packages, which is Red Hat Package Manager. And distributions like Ubuntu use Debian packages, .deb packages. But installing them is even easier. In a standard Ubuntu system, you can go to the menu, click Add Remove Software, and you get a gigantic menu full of software, and you just have to click what you want and click install. You don't have to touch anything in the command line anymore.
Oh, wow. That has come a long ways. I have not seen that.
I think it is in that aspect, in that certain point, that Linux has matured and has made it ready for the desktop, because basically it is easier to install software on a Linux or an Ubuntu Linux system than on a standard Vista system, because on a Windows system, you have to download everything, put it on your desktop, run the XE, go through the installer. And on a Ubuntu system, you just go to the Start menu or the Ubuntu menu, click Add Remove, select what software you want, click the check mark, and it will pull it in, install it, and it's done.
Now, how do they have a list of everything that's out there? I mean, every obscure little application that you might ever want to run is in that list? Or is it just big stuff?
There's a lot of stuff. We have what is called repositories, which can be defined as big boxes of software. And the software that's in there is supported by Ubuntu or by the Ubuntu community, which means it's maintained. And from the software in the repositories, you can just, pick and choose what you want. If you want something that's not in the repositories, you can either download the Debian from the website of the user or from the creator of the software, or just really download the source code and go make install and stuff like that. But I don't even know how to do that. So I've just used the repository so far, and it works just great.
Wow, that definitely has come a long way. Now, is that why you would go towards something like Ubuntu for a mainstream kind of user?
Yeah, I would. If I take a look at the users that we work with, if they're on a Windows system, I don't want to bash Windows, just a fact. They get viruses and spyware in no time, and we have to continue to support them and clean their systems. And Niana is really going like, oh, God, yeah, because it takes up so much of our time. And when we give those people a Linux system, they can still do all the things they do on the net, but they don't have a system that is so prone to infection. So for people who go like, look, I want to do mail, surf, office documents, web-based stuff, and that is not really pointing towards some kind of Windows-specific application, I would give them a Linux system and they would be happy ever after. They would be in a much secure environment and would have a much more time to enjoy their computer instead of maintaining it.
Now, the best example you have of this is that you actually gave Niana's grandmother Linux?
Yeah, we did. And she loves it.
Really?
How many laptops does she have by now?
Yeah, she has two laptops at the moment.
Oh, wow.
Both on Linux.
And Niana, tell me, how did that come about? How did you guys talk her into that?
Yeah, she likes doing games. The little games, not the difficult ones, but the very simple ones. And then we had an old laptop.
Windows 95 or something, and she had like five games?
And then you had the idea from, we'll put Linux on it. And since then, it's how many years?
I think she's
for a very long time.
Yeah, she's doing it for 3 years now or something.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So because the games were available, though.
Yeah, she has hundreds of games on it. And yeah, she's playing it every night, every day.
Are these web-based? Are they web-based games, or are they...
No.
Okay, so they're actually installed on... So how did you find the games that were the same as the one she was playing?
She was like playing Solitaire, Minesweeper, and Tetris.
Okay, the classics.
The classics. Yeah. And there were about a million clones of those out there. So we just installed... I installed a basic Ubuntu on her system. I kind of made the interface a little simpler for her, so because you can really customize the menu and stuff. So she had like a button to see all her games and play all her games, a button to shut down the computer, and that was it. So she was, and now she has one. Yeah, it's really simple for her. I just installed a basic Ubuntu, went to the software directory, and clicked on every game in the directory. So now she has hundreds of them.
Wow.
And she's played all of them.
One by one.
Now, has she become a more sophisticated user over time, or is she still going with the really simple install?
She's still going with the simple install, yeah.
But she has become more demanding.
Yeah.
I mean... she's her computer. We had her on the phone, I think.
Last Friday, she called. She was in a big panic because her computer was dead.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no. What do? I call my granddaughter and her husband. And you'll try to explain her everything. But, yeah, she got a little bit nervous. So when went over there on Saturday and we explained her everything she had to do when the computer was going down. So now she can do it herself.
Yeah, she just let the battery drain. So the Ubuntu system went into hibernate mode and she couldn't pull it back from there. So we just reset the system. But we're talking about somebody who has used that computer leisurely once or twice to somebody who calls a general alert when one of her two systems are not working.
One of her two. Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, what's the second system set up like? The same?
About the same. She has one. Let me see. That's an old Compaq NC600. That's a bigger laptop. And she has a Triple E PC.
Oh.
So one of the small ones. And she explicitly wanted one because we actually imported one from the States. Because she said, like, that's ultra portable. I can take it with me anywhere. I can play my games anywhere. This 82-year-old lady was demanding portability.
I love it.
And, She loves it. She goes to what's it like? The hobby. It's a senior citizens meeting.
Uh-huh.
And the other senior citizens just sit there and they sew something.
They knit.
Or they knit or they play cards. And she just sits there with her
computer.
Triple E PC going frozen bubble like there's no tomorrow.
I love it. Now, she doesn't speak English by any chance, does she?
Unfortunately.
She
doesn't. Yeah, oh, shoot.
We wanted to get her on. I've even thought of doing an interview with her, but we have to think of overdubbing everything. And while she doesn't speak any English, she's been featured in the Full Circle magazine, which is an online Linux magazine, for I think 3 times already.
Oh, neat!
And and she had a friend of her translate the articles that were about her, and she has them. And everybody who comes by, she's like showing them and going like, yeah, I was in this week's episode of Full Circle magazine and blah, blah, blah. And she was in there quite a few times.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love it. Well, let's shift gears a little bit here. So my husband Steve downloaded your latest Nightwise screencast, and it was part 2 of an episode about how to install Linux servers. So one of the questions he asked me says, why? Why would you want to install a Linux server? What would you do with it? Can you hook up different kinds of computers to it? Can you have Macs and PCs talking to it? And what would you have them talk to it about? You know, what would it be for?
Well, the series that I'm doing for the moment is installing a Linux server, but a very, very simple one. Basically, the first thing that you can let your server do, of course, is function as a file and print server. Now, that's actually a little bit harder to set up, but there are great tools like Webmin, which give your Ubuntu Linux server an interface as the interface on your router, just really point-and-click web-based. And you can make new shares and give people rights to those shares. You can use it as a file server. You could use it as a print server. You can run a web server on it, you know, just host your own intranet website. I use it to also connect when I'm on the road. I use it to connect via kind of a VPN connection to my Linux server that always gives me an encrypted connection no matter where I am. So if I'm on a hotspot, I can very easily tunnel back home and surf through the tunnel starting out here, so not to have my traffic sniffed, or I can access my files over here. I have a few very simple command line programs running, like Alpine, so I can check my Gmail using the command line from anywhere. I have my MSN and my Google Talk accounts on there. I have a command line based. I've got IRC chat on there, command line based. So they're very simple to install and to configure, but they give you great joy because you can let Windows machines connect. You can let Macs connect. Anything works with anything, basically. And and you can, even if you have installed the server, install the workstation part on top of that and also have a very powerful plain workstation.
So as you walked through the list of those things, I'm trying to think what would be a mainstream use. I'm not sure, and a command line IRC chat would be quite what I'd be looking for. But you bring up the VPN is interesting. So you're able to do that, and you don't have to pay anybody a service to have that VPN tunneling then?
No, absolutely not. You can set up, I've got two kinds of servers that I know how to set up because I'm really basically learning this as I go. One is an SSH tunnel, which only has, you only have to open one little port on your router, that's port 22, towards your Linux server, and then you can connect to it from anywhere. You can tell your Firefox to go via your Linux server and surf out from there, so having a web tunnel VPN. Through that same port, you can also drag and drop files to your Linux server, so you can use it as a Dropbox, and it's an encrypted connection. Nobody can see your traffic. And if you install that webmin, that web-based interface, it's very easy to install a real VPN server which you can use to connect from your Mac by setting up a standard VPN connection to your home. So it's like being part of the network of your house, and you don't have to pay anybody. It doesn't cost anything, and it's fairly easy to set up.
Now that's kind of interesting. One thing, I would like to hear what Bart has to say about what you're doing. I know he's mentioned before that it's a pretty frightening thing to have a mail server on an internal machine on your network and not open yourself up to all kinds of vulnerabilities by doing that. I don't know what he would say about running a VPN server. I'd be curious to see what he says when he gets back.
Well, basically, that's something that's doable, because most of the services that I mentioned, the SSH tunnel and the VPN server, are only accessible to you because you need a password to get in. Now, if you want to build your own mail server, well, you will have to talk to other mail servers, and you kind of open your server up to a broader expanse of the internet. And I wouldn't start doing that if especially on a home network. Even I don't do stuff like that. I let Google take care of my email. I mean,
that's pretty much what Bart said. He said, even I won't do that, so don't even think about it.
The bummer is if you can say, like, look, I'm going to host my own very own mail server. But, you know, if the power goes out, so it does your mail server. So I don't use it for real critical systems. I just use it to connect back home.
So how big of a machine do you need to create to set up a Linux server that would be able to do the VPN tunneling for you?
For how many users? It's about
one at a
family.
Time.
One at a time.
Yeah, I mean, less than three.
Well, let's see. A Pentium 2.
Oh, wow.
366 with 128 megabytes of RAM will get you started.
How about a Mac Mini with a VM on it?
Doable. Give it about 265 megabytes of RAM, no problem.
Wow.
It depends on how many users you want to throw on there. If you want to run the graphical interface as well, it needs a little bit more processor power and memory. But the command line version only, we've done it on an old Compaq Armada P3500, which had a busted screen. The keyboard was busted. So we just had it, you know, we put it on a shelf somewhere, hooked a network cable into it. It was a great server. It ran for like 2 years.
You know, I was thinking about what we're going to do with Steve's G5. He's probably going to upgrade to a 24-inch iMac for his birthday this year after the new models come out, hopefully. And I was thinking, well, what is there something we can put the G5 to use? And it sounds like it would be massive overkill to run a VPN server on that, especially the fact that I think it's about $200 a month in electrical use, because that thing is a big power hog. But it's a nice heater.
That's true.
I think you guys could use it in your house today, actually.
Yeah. We were just banging away on our heater, which doesn't work for the moment, so that's okay. I've got Niana next to me with her hoodie on and everything. She looks like some kind of a pink gang member, but it's okay. Well, what I think if we would have a spare G5, we would just put it in the living room. So everybody would be able to see it. We would tell them it would be a Mac Pro with unbelievable octa-core power and, you know, just use it to show off. But indeed, the G5 might be a little bit overkill. So if you still got an old PC or some room to run a VM, it's great, because you have to, you know, it does, you know, suck up power if you run your own server. But if you have an old laptop with a busted screen or something, it's great. It works great.
I'm afraid the only PC that ever was in my house was a Windows PC that I built for my son about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. I think I've told the story on the show a few times, but I was really sad after I built it because he started using it all the time and he stopped using his iBook. And I was really depressed by the fact that the Windows PC really had his attention. And I had bought it so he could play games and stuff. But I started noticing he was web browsing on it. He was doing his email. He was doing his chat. And then I had a brilliant idea. I bought a KVM switch and I hooked it up to the PC and to his iBook. And the PC was never turned on again. It was the big monitor and keyboard that he wanted.
Wisdom comes with age, Allison. Wisdom comes with age.
I finally sold that machine off for what I bought it, what I paid to build it. So it was a fun learning experience. But there's not been any Windows in the house intentionally past that.
That's how I lost my my iBook. I had an iBook, which was my first Mac, and I accidentally lent it to somebody in this room, who afterward was snarling, growling, and drooling at me like a flaming, possessed pit bull terrier, that she wanted to keep it and never want anything else. And you never looked back. You never had a PC anymore, did you?
Never.
You know, a lot of people think that they talk about how it's actually a big chore to switch. But we hooked Steve's parents up with a MacBook to start with, switching from a Windows 98 Dell. And within, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, I noticed in an email from his father, who was in his 70s, saying he used the word play when he referred to his computer. And this is a man who had never enjoyed his computer in any way, shape, or form. It was a misery to him. You know, I mean, he could function on it, but the word play never would have come into his conversation. And now, in fact, I was thinking of doing an interview with him just to ask him, you know, what was the transition like? Because he'll tell you it was a piece of cake. And, you know, he's not a computer guy at all, but he loves it and his wife loves it. So now they have two. They have a 20-inch iMac and the original MacBook. And with the exception of some problems with their wireless router cutting in and out, which causes great consternation, it's been a pretty smooth ride.
I think when we switched, the only thing that we had an inkling of trouble with was the fact that MSN Messenger on the Mac didn't have webcam support. And we kind of solved that, and we said to people, do you want to see us? Yes, we do. Get Skype. And with that, that was solved. So we actually moved everybody over to Skype if they wanted to have a webcam talk with us, because that works on the Mac too. And we've actually never looked back. I think MSN was the only thing holding us – well, not holding us back, but being annoying. But how was the switch for you? Because you switched in a very short time.
Yeah. I switched from one day to the other.
Just cold turkey overnight, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't want to go back, and I didn't have any trouble to find stuff. Yeah, how can I say it? Mac explains itself. If you do something wrong, boop, you have to do this. And yeah.
I remember.
For me, it's quite.
Go ahead.
For me, it was quite simple.
I had a couple of friends. The one guy was thinking about going to the Mac, and the other guy was a hardcore PC guy. And he said to him, no, Chet, there's no way you can't switch. Because you know how, like on Windows, you have an X in the upper right? It's a red dot in the upper left. How are you ever going to find that?
Oh, my God.
It was frightening.
The lines that we always use is, if you want to work for your computer, get a PC. If you want to work with your computer, get a Mac.
Yeah. I don't use Windows very much. I do use it at work, and I've described it. It's just sort of like having somebody lightly scratch you on the arm all day long. You know, it's not that bad. It's just after a while, you're just like, just get off of me. Leave me alone.
Well, it depends. I'm a slider, so I work 8 hours a day on a Windows machine on a Vista machine. I'm getting used to it. I've got my Linux machines lying around here. I've got this little Acer Aspire 1 mini notebook running Ubuntu. I used to have my MacBook Pro, but now somebody in the room here keeps hogging it all day. And again, I get the snarling and the growling and the drooling and the infested look going like, "Arr, mine." So I jump around on several systems, but if I want to get things done, if I want to be creative, we use the Mac because, quite frankly, the podcast that we do, the videos that we produce together, because Niana has been featured on the new episode of KWTV, it's all so smooth on the Mac that if we had to do this on a PC, we would be, you know, we wouldn't just...
We would go insane.
There you go.
You know, you said you're used to it, and I would definitely say I'm used to it on Windows. I'm used to Vista, but I don't find that when I go back to the Mac, I'm thinking, oh, I wish I had that, with the exception of one thing. I want to grab any side of any window and resize the window. It drives me nuts when I get back to the Mac and I have to grab the bottom right-hand corner. And but that is the only thing I think of. And then when I go over to Windows, I'm like, just like, oh, I wish it did this. I wish it did this. I wish it did this. I wish it did this.
I miss the keyboard shortcuts from the Mac on the Windows machine.
Like Command Tab and things like that, or
like, well, Command Tab kind of works, but you know, there are some on the like Apple key space for the Finder and stuff. That's not really available on the Windows machine. But because I've learned to use the keyboard more and more since I'm on the Mac.
So when you say Apple space, you mean like going into Spotlight to launch applications?
Yeah.
Try Launchy from launchy.net. It's a cheesy little sort of unreliable, you know, sometimes it quits itself for no apparent reason application. But it's a real nice application launcher. And you can pick random letters out of the word. Like if you want to launch Excel, you could type E-E-L and it would find it because Excel has two E's and an L in it.
I always kind of bork that up. I never know how to spell Excel.
Well, this is the one for you then. This is perfect.
Yeah. The thing with the tabs, you know, but it's okay. But I must say, what we find here, for example, my Acer Aspire 1 is a machine that came with Windows XP Home. I nuked that. So I made a dual boot into Ubuntu Linux. So it has XP and Ubuntu Linux. And I have modified the graphical user shell of Ubuntu Linux to look like a Mac. So it's kind of the worst of all three.
Nice. Hey, well, I better wrap us up. We've been yammering on here for quite a long time. Let me get you to pimp every way they can find both of you. Let's start with Niana. What's your, are you on Twitter?
No. I'm not.
Allison, do me one favor. Tell her to get on Twitter.
Oh, she's not on Twitter. Come on. Twitter's awesome.
I told you that he mustn't sit so much on Twitter because a few weeks ago, he was in a car. I knew he was in a car and at
Facebook.
Facebook, excuse me. Yes, Facebook. Sometimes it is. At Facebook, I saw his
updates.
His updates. I thought, oh no, he's in the car. And I went ballistic when he got home.
I got home. I was in so much trouble.
That was the day you called Joe Hendricks.
Oh, yeah, I was called Mr. Hendricks.
Yeah, probably not wise in the car. They did make that illegal here. We can't do any kind of texting in the car, and it's really hard to stop. I would only do it at stop signs, but
over here you can't. Also,
I got told off. I had to be more careful.
All right. Well, anyway, so all right. Well, where can we find Nightwise? Give all the different links you got there.
Well, just one: www.nightwise.com. That's KNIGHTWISE.com. For life on the edge of real and cyberspace, you can find the podcast there. You can find the episodes of KWTV there. And, and you can find Niana there.
Oh, you can.
We've got about 3,000. Yeah, we got 3,000 pictures on Flickr. And you can look for us on Facebook for as well. You just look for Nightwise and Saskiahu Fact. Try spelling that one.
All right. And on Twitter, you're twitter.com/Nightwise, I think.
Very simple.
All right, Niana and Nightwise, this was a lot of fun talking to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that really was a fun time getting to talk to Nightwise and Niana. That was a really good time. We actually talked for probably another 45 minutes after that, but that was a really good time. Anyway, I'm going to have to wrap this show up. It looks like it's not going to go an hour and 11 minutes, but pretty darn close to it. We've been getting longer and longer, I think, but the chat room keeps saying, longer, longer. Speaking of the chat room, you guys should head on over to ustream.tv and look up the NoSillaCast in there and come join the crowd at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday nights. We have a great time, good group, and everybody's a lot of fun in there. So let's see, other ways you should be able to get a hold of me. Be sure to email me at allison@podfeed.com. I love to get questions, comments, even when you're snotty to me and say you don't like stuff. That's okay, because I'm going to learn something from you, that's for sure. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeed. And I have a great time in there. We just have a really good time. In fact, you should follow twitter.com/SP Sheridan if you want to hear what Steve's doing, because he's been finding some cool stuff lately. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.